Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear an audio clip from mental health professionals about why people are resistant to hearing the evidence that challenges the official story of 9/11. This clip was created by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and includes some of the mental health professionals who have signed their petition for a new investigation. If you've ever tried to explain some of the evidence that challenges the official story of 9/11 to resistant friends or family members, I'm sure you'll find this segment interesting because toward the end, they give some suggestions on how to talk to people about 9/11. That will be followed by a clip on terrorists created by and then caught by the FBI. And then that'll be followed by some information on Occupy Hartford. So let's get started. Here's the clip from the mental health professionals. You'll hear Richard Gage's voice introducing the clip.
Most of us who have lived with the events of 9/11 have, as a result, experienced some kind of trauma. It can be very difficult to come to terms with what actually happened at the World Trade Center. In fact, someone told me recently, "I wouldn't believe what you're telling me even if it were true." Our petition signers, with psychological expertise, have stepped forward to offer their insight. While this segment is clearly outside the knowledge base of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, these experts in psychology highlight their valuable experience for us as to why this evidence can still be so difficult for people to accept.
At this point, we have 9 years of hard scientific evidence that disproves the government theory about what happened on September 11th, and yet people continue to be either oblivious to the fact that this information exists or completely resistant to looking at this information. So the question becomes why? Why is it that people have so much trouble hearing this information? From my work, I think we would be remiss not to look at the impact of trauma. My name is Marty Hopper, and I'm a PhD clinical psychologist. I've been working and living for the past 30 years here in Boulder, Colorado. For the past 11 years, my work has focused on helping people who have experienced personal trauma. Now, as we know, the horrors of what happened on 9/11 were televised all over the world, and they were televised, in fact, live. We witnessed the deaths of almost 3,000 of our fellow Americans. We know this had a very severe and traumatic impact on a majority of the population. I myself cried for weeks after September 11th. A friend of mine who is a psychologist in practice here in Boulder said that her caseload increased tremendously after 9/11, and people that she hadn't seen in 10 years were coming back into her practice. So I think it's safe to say that collectively as a nation, because of what happened on September 11th, we experienced trauma.
I'm Fran Schur, and I have a master's degree from the University of Colorado. I've had a private practice as a psychotherapist and as a licensed professional counselor for about 20 years. Why do people resist this information, the information that shows that the official story about 9/11 cannot be true? What I've learned is that as humans, each of us have a worldview, and that worldview is usually formed in great part by the culture we grow up in. When we hear information that contradicts our worldview, social psychologists call the resulting insecurity cognitive dissonance. For example, with 9/11, we have one cognition, which is what the official story of 9/11, what our government told us, what our media repeated to us over and over, that 19 Muslims attacked us. On the other hand, we have what scientists, researchers, architects, engineers are now beginning to tell us, which is that there is evidence that shows that the official story cannot be true. So now we've lost our sense of security. We are starting to feel vulnerable. Now we're confused.
9/11 truth challenges some of our most fundamental beliefs about our government and about our country. When your beliefs are challenged or when two beliefs are inconsistent, cognitive dissonance is created. 9/11 truth challenges the beliefs that our country protects us and keeps us safe and that America is the good guy. My name is Bob Hopper and I have a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Cincinnati. For the past 29 years, I've been a licensed PhD clinical psychologist in Boulder, Colorado. When your beliefs are challenged, fear and anxiety are created. In response to that, our psychological defenses kick in, and they protect us from these emotions. Denial, which is probably the most primitive psychological defense, is the one most likely to kick in when our beliefs are challenged.
I'm Danielle Dupre, PhD, originally from Switzerland, where I studied psychology and psychoanalysis. For the past 15 years, I've been empowering people who have experienced significant trauma. America is a powerful nation. It has never been attacked. We were confident, we felt secure, and all of a sudden that security collapsed. People started to be fearful. With all those rumors, those news, people didn't know what to think about. And it's a very, very uncomfortable state to be in. And eventually, our mind shuts off. Just like when a computer is overloaded, our minds get overloaded. We can't handle it anymore, and we shut down. It's easier to deny it and move on with our lives.
What some of us will tend to do is deny the evidence that's coming our way and stick to the original story, the official story, and to try to regain our equilibrium in that way. Another thing we can do is decide to look at the conflicting evidence and be sincere and be open-minded and look at both sides of the issue and then make up our own mind about what reality is.
I'm Dorothy Lorig. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology from the University of Colorado, and I've been practicing reevaluation counseling for over 16 years. If we can think of our worldview as being sort of our mental and emotional home, I think all of us will do just about anything to defend our homes, to defend our families. And so I see that with people, and I saw that with myself when my brother tried to talk with me about it, of don't mess with me, don't mess with my home, don't mess with my comfort with how things are. And about a week later, I read a lengthy article by Professor Griffin about why he believes the official account of 9/11 cannot be true. And it was a very well-researched article. I was in my office at the time. I sat there and I felt my stomach churning. I thought maybe I was going to be sick. And I leaped out of my chair and ran out the door and took a long walk around the block, around several blocks, and just broke down. I understand now that what was happening was my worldview about my government being in some way my protector, almost like a parent, had been dashed, and it was like being cast out into the wilderness, I think is the closest way to describe that feeling. And I sobbed, felt like the ground had completely disappeared beneath my feet. And I knew at some point during the walk that I knew that I was going to have to become active in educating other people about this, that for me to retain any sense of integrity, I was going to have to take some action. I couldn't just let something like this go.
Many people respond to these truths in a very deep way. Some have a visceral reaction like they've been punched in the stomach. To begin to accept the possibility that the government was involved is like opening Pandora's box. If you open the lid and peek in a little bit, it's going to challenge some of your fundamental beliefs about the world.
I'm David Ray Griffin. I taught philosophy of religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. I published about 35 books in my field, but then starting in 2004, I started publishing about 9/11, and since that time I have published 10 books about 9/11. You have empirical people who will simply say, look at the evidence, and if it's convincing, I will change my mind. Other people are paradigmatic people. They have a paradigm. They say, this is the way the world works, and I'm convinced this is the right way the world works. 9/11 doesn't fit into that paradigm, so I don't need to look at the evidence. It's paradigmatic. And then there is a third type of person that we often call wishful thinkers. I call it wishful and fearful thinking. So they simply will not believe something that they fear to be the truth. And I found that maybe to be the most powerful factor of people rejecting 9/11 truth and not even entertaining the evidence.
So whenever we say, I refuse to believe, we can be sure that the evidence that's coming our way is not bearable, and that it's conflicting with our worldview much too much.
Denial protects people from this kind of anxiety.
As I thought about all of these responses, I realized that what is common to every one of them is the emotion of fear. People are afraid of being ostracized, they're afraid of being alienated, they're afraid of being shunned, they're afraid of their lives being inconvenienced, they'd have to change their lives, they're afraid of being confused, they're afraid of psychological deterioration, they're afraid of feeling helpless and vulnerable, and they're afraid that they won't be able to handle the feelings that are coming up. None of us want to feel helpless and vulnerable, so we want to defend ourselves, and the way we often do that is with anger. So then we become angry, and when we become angry, then we become indignant, we become offended, we want to ridicule the messenger, we want to pathologize the messenger, and we want to censor the messenger.
So how can we overcome this resistance and denial? The first thing is to meet people where they're at.
One thing is that we need to raise people's awareness about this through what I would call gentle dialogue and gentle questioning. My name is John Freedom. I'm a counselor in private practice here in Tucson, Arizona, which I've been for the past 20 years. I hold a master's level certification in NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming. So it doesn't work to challenge people's belief or immediately tell them, you know, I know the truth about 9/11, but a good way is to ask questions, ask open-ended questions, and lead them into a dialogue and discussion about it.
Healing comes through facing the truth, experiencing it, allowing the feelings to come in, so that if there are feelings of fear that perhaps these events were caused by something that we haven't thought about yet, dark elements within our society, for example, we'll let that come in and explore it. Let the light shine on whatever happened. This will be the most healing process. The Germans did this after their war. The South Africans did this after apartheid. Reconciliation through the truth is what is a deep path to psychological recovery from the myths and lies around which this historic event has been cloaked in the official view. I am Professor William Woodward. I'm trained in the history of science with a PhD. I also have a master's in experimental psychology. I've edited 4 books and published well over 20 peer-reviewed papers. I've taught for 35 years at a state university, University of New Hampshire. I think as a psychologist, to overcome our fear of the traumatic event with new information would be the best, healthiest route to our collective recovery from the trauma of 9/11. That, by the way, is a psychotherapeutic insight that to gradually uncover the truth in your own life, the sources of anxiety, to make them conscious, is the royal road to recovery.
One of the ways to deal with the trauma is to find the answers. That's why I think it is of such importance to have a comprehensive investigation.
To work together to expose what happened, regardless of where the evidence takes us. That's what we expect in our state government, law enforcement. I think that by putting science together with the law, we will have a psychological healing around the impossible cognition that has been produced on that day.
I believe that to be the kind of country that we think we are, we have to face some of the things that are not as we think they are. I'm Robert Griffin. I am a licensed psychologist practicing in Pennsylvania for 25 years. I am a member of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, and I am past president of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Psychological Association. After World War II, part of the way that Jewish people honored the dead was by making sure that the truth was known and that the value of these people was respected. Not pursuing the truth about 9/11 disrespects the value of the life of the people that died. Thinking that we're above such things, that it could happen in other countries, but it couldn't happen here, that's a lack of humility, and that's excessive pride. And so not being able to see our dark side or our weaknesses is the most dangerous thing.
The observation that pride is one of the basic human flaws is absolutely correct. This is especially true for Americans because we long, for a long time, looked at other nations and say, oh, they're in such bad shape. But luckily, we don't have those problems. We don't have leaders who would do those things that were done in the Soviet Union or done in Germany or done in Japan and on down the list. So this is a type of pride that Americans have. A feature of American history that makes us particularly liable to this pride is this notion that's called exceptionalism, that America is the exceptional nation. And that began from the beginning. As this country was formed, people would say, well, there was so much evil in the European country, so much cheating, so much lying, so much using the people for the ruler's purposes, but not in America. We have leaders that are free from those sins. So I think this has made 9/11 particularly difficult for Americans.
Anyone can make mistakes, but our ideals and our principles get us back, you know, on track.
This is one of the defining issues of our time.
So we need to understand that questioning is patriotic. Questioning is what we're supposed to do as citizens. That's our duty.
When we come to the national level, when something like 9/11 happens, we need to be sure that we have a real investigation into who the perpetrators are, and then we need to be sure that those perpetrators are held legally accountable. It's part of the healing process on the individual level as on the collective level. We need the truth in order to heal.
And now you're going to hear a recent clip by Judge Napolitano of Fox News telling us about how the FBI sets up its own terrorist attacks and then catches the perpetrators that they set up. I see this as a psychological operation to keep you in fear of domestic and foreign terrorist threats so that you'll support military spending. That's more than half of our national budget, and so that you'll support wars, torture, curtailment of your civil liberties, body scanners, surveillance cameras at major traffic lights, all in the name of protecting you from the bad guys who, as it now looks like, were created by and then captured by the FBI. And here's the clip.
Does the government work for us or do we work for the government? Can the federal government take credit for saving us from a plot of its own creation? Tonight, has the federal government kept us safe, or does it just want us to think that it has kept us safe? Since the tragedy of 9/11, numerous crazies and low-level copycats have engaged in criminal behavior which they hoped would result in the deaths of innocent Americans and somehow advance their cause of jihad. If you ask the leadership of the FBI, most of whose field agents are tireless, dedicated, Constitution-supporting professionals, it will tell you that the FBI, has foiled about 17 plots to kill Americans during the past 10 years. What it will not tell you is that there have been 20 foiled plots, and of them, 3 were interrupted by members of the public. The 17 that were interrupted by the feds were created by the feds. We all remember the 3 that were foiled by diligent Americans: the shoe bomber, the underwear bomber, and the Times Square bomber. In all of these cases, the crimes charged were those of attempting to kill and conspiring with others to do so. In all 3 of those cases, alert Americans on transcontinental flights or in the streets of New York City told authorities of bizarre behavior or actually subdued the threats themselves. There was no foiling by the FBI. The plotters were, thankfully, bumbling fools who had poorly planned their criminal behavior and who ended up harming no one. All 3 are serving life terms. But the more curious cases are the remaining 17 for which the federal government has taken credit. They all have a common and reprehensible thread. They were planned, plotted, controlled, and carried out by the federal government itself. In all of these 17 cases, from the Fort Dix 6 to the Lackawanna 7 to the Portland Parade bomber, the feds found young men of Muslim backgrounds, loners who were bitter at America. They befriended them, cajoled them, and persuaded them that they could change the world by killing Americans. In all these cases, agents worked undercover and portrayed themselves to the targets as Arabs of like un-American mind. In some cases, the federal agents used third parties to act as middlemen. The third parties were typically persons who had been convicted of crimes and who, in return for leniency at their own sentencings, were willing to work with the same feds who prosecuted them in order to help the feds entrap whomever else those feds were pursuing. Thus, in all 17 of these cases, because of the command and control of federal agents, no one was ever in danger, no one was harmed, no bomb went off, and no property was damaged. But in all those cases, the losers whom the feds targeted each believed that they were interacting with real plotters who would bring them cash and bombs. As we know, sometimes the cash arrived, but the bombs never did. The defendants were essentially charged and convicted for playing a game with federal agents. The most recent of those government-generated plots was revealed yesterday. It has a new twist because it allegedly involves agents of the intelligence apparatus of the government of Iran. It, too, was destined to go nowhere as the feds monitored and taped every move made by their target as he interacted with federal agents whom he stupidly believed to be drug dealers and co-conspirators. Today, the feds themselves revealed that high officials of Iran's government knew nothing of this. Of course, the neocons have demanded bombs on Tehran, no matter what the government there knew. And this plot came to light the day before Attorney General Holder himself was subpoenaed by Congress in the Fast and Furious case. You get the picture. Are any of these plots criminal? Can the government just pick and choose whom to seduce and then lower the boom at the right time and arrest its would-be Confederates? Is this a proper and efficient use of law enforcement resources? The answers to these questions are obvious, and they are not good. The courts have made this legal, so long as the target of these plots had a mental predisposition to cause harm. But none of this keeps us safe. All of this makes us less free, as any one of us can be entrapped. And we are fools if we praise the government for exposing a plot of its own creation and saving us from a danger that never existed. Can the government break the law in order to enforce it? Well, when it does, it becomes a law unto itself, and the rule of law dies as the feds decide whom to target and whom to trap. Think about it. Are we really safe in a false sense of security? Why do we pay the government to trick us into believing it is keeping us safe? When no one is harmed and the government controls the plot, aren't we just punishing someone for his thoughts? And in a free society, aren't free people free to think as they wish? This must be so, because if the government can punish our thoughts, there are no limits to its power. From New York, defending freedom every night of the week. So long, America.
And now I want to share some information with you on the Occupy Hartford movement. The Occupy Hartford group is located on the corner of Broad Street and Farmington Avenue in Hartford. And on Thursday, October 27th, they've organized a campus walkout. So at 2 p.m., students and faculty from UConn, University of Hartford, Trinity, Wesleyan, Central, Eastern, and more will be walking off the campus and joining the Occupy Hartford folks at 3 p.m. There'll be a rally and a march, a teach-in, dinner, music, and fun. And if you want more information, you can go to their website, which is OccupyHartfordCT.com. And if you'd like to help the Occupy Hartford group, from their website, this is what they say they need. Most important, your presence at the camp. We are always in need of folks who can come by the camp, lend a hand for whatever comes up, to help spot overnighters who may want to run home for a shower, or to speak to interested people. If you have the time, even for an hour, it will mean everything to the campers. The food committee is looking for volunteers to take lunch and dinner shifts at the food tent for serving and cleaning and trash removal. You can contact them by emailing OccupyHartfordFoodies@gmail.com. So that's OccupyHartfordFoodies@gmail.com to sign up for a shift. High on our needs list is ice, a laptop, scissors, sewing, knitting, crafting supplies, cassette tapes, books for the library, collage materials, any drawing and painting implements, paint, paper, cardboard, canvas, poster board, other materials for signs and banners, yardsticks, posts, stakes, wood, glass jars, staplers, clothes to offer to people as they need them due to inclement weather and temperature, hats, mittens, gloves, sweatshirts, sweaters, wool socks, raincoats, and/or ponchos, a thick chain for locking bikes, canvas, laptop, musical instruments, tables, tarps, tents, trash cans, wood pallets, stones for holding stuff down in windy conditions, power extension cords, gas cans, lights, LED or solar, walkie-talkies, safety vests, video projector, an umbrella table or canopy, deep cycle marine battery, hats and gloves, radios. And for wellness, they need 4 wall hangings for the walls of the quiet tent, chairs, shelves, vases, potted plants, tea, and teapots. So that's the list so far. If you want more information on the Occupy Hartford group, you can go to OccupyHartfordCT.com. For more information on Occupy Wall Street, you can go to Occupy Wall Street, and that's with an ST for street, .org. And there's also a website called OccupyTogether.org where you can see the thousands of places around the world that are now holding occupying events. So let's show our support for these people who are exercising our 99% collective power. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.